Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Me Too. Over the past several weeks, millions of women have revealed that they, too, have been victims of sexual harassment or abuse. In today's episode, we bring you another Me Too from graduate student Heather Burtman. Cleopatra Coleman stars in Fox's The Last Man on Earth and Showtime's White Famous. She reads Heather's essay, My Body Doesn't Belong to You.
When the stranger yelled at me from his car window, I was carrying my Zamiococcus zamiifolia, a large tropical plant I had just bought at a greenhouse. I couldn't hear what he said, but I don't think he was complimenting my plant. His words, whatever they were, brought to mind all of the derogatory comments and crude propositions I had heard before. From different car windows and different men, all of the comments about my body and suggestions for what I could do with it. It was as if once I turned 16, my body no longer belonged to me, but to the world at large, and to certain men who drove their cars past it. When I was a little girl, playing shirtless in my family's garden, my body felt as if it belonged only to me. We had a rectangle-shaped yard out of which we would dig a smaller rectangle, and this dark patch of soil would become our garden. At 5, 6, and 7 years old, my siblings and I laughed as we shook out fat chunks of grass and produced a shower of dirt that went up our noses and down our chests. I liked the way the dirt felt, all freshly dug against my skin, and I asked my mother to bury me in it the way she sometimes did at the beach. She buried me halfway, and I smiled and posed for a picture. I liked being that way. A bare, muddy torso with a handful of seeds that I thought might grow carrots and yield a future in which my body was my body. And your body was your body. During my senior year of high school, I went in for my second bra fitting at JCPenney, where the fitter sniffed a little in disapproval when telling me my cup size, as if she were thinking, "How dare you grow those?" I was now the keeper of this secret. There are sizes beyond double D. You can be an H, for example. That is British sizing. Or a K. That is American sizing. The British make better bras. I was the girl with the big breasts. There were jokes, compliments from female friends, promises that my future boyfriend or husband or lover would have plenty to be happy about. There were men who stared. Men who asked, "Are those real?" I had no answer. I didn't remember consciously deciding about their size or doing anything about it. Around then, I realized that, in this world, there would be many instances when my body would not feel like my body. When I was in a club and a man grabbed my butt and then my hands, trying to pull me in to dance, you can say no 100 times, and he will still pull. There is the knot of your hands and his, and the harder you pull away, the harder he pulls closer. It is like a game to him, like one of those colorful woven tubes that trap your fingers when you exert opposing forces. If you are lucky, your friends will yell at him until he lets go. You will stand there stunned, suddenly realizing how sticky the dance floor is. Also wondering if they have a nice-smelling hand soap in the bathroom. Hand soap that smells like summer air. Being young. Outside. But that is the smell of another world entirely. One that no longer seems to exist. When I walk to work, and men smile at me along the way, they don't have nice smiles anymore. "What's your name?" they say. "Come on, sweetheart, tell me your name." They follow me, their footsteps like trees falling. I can feel it in the air, their need to take something from me. It has nothing to do with me in particular, with me as an individual. It has nothing to do with how I was once a fearless, naked gardener with a blue plastic teapot and a collection of puzzles. If I were to tell them my name, would they remember it? Would they invite me out to a nice dinner and listen as I told them stories about my childhood? Would this be true love? I can picture the scene now. I'm at brunch with my girlfriends at a place that serves bottomless Bloody Marys and slightly overcooked eggs. After round three, we find ourselves on the usual subject, how we met our significant others. My girlfriends lean in a little closer and say, "Oh, Heather, please tell the story again. Tell us how you and Lyle met." "Well," I begin, taking one last sip of Bloody Mary, "I was walking down the street when Lyle drove by and yelled, 'Hey, baby,' and asked me to have sex with him. And I thought, this one's a keeper." Such behavior is not about me. It's not about love. It's not even about sex. It is about fear and power. What certain men gain from feeding on such things, I do not know. And I do not want to know. While traveling in France one year, I held onto my friend's arm as a man followed us for maybe half a mile, yelling something I didn't understand. There was the glittering river, the stone bridge, the creperie closed for the night. Only the fear really existed. "We can take him," I whispered to her. "I mean, if anything happens." We marched forward, eyeing the distance between the hunted and the hunter. I was too scared to think, and uncertain of how one even got a hold of the police out there. In Connecticut one day, a man drove past me only to turn around and come back. "Oh my God," I thought. "He came back." I felt the fear descending upon me the way a colorful parachute does in a childhood game of cat and mouse. He talked. He laughed. He watched me try not to blink. I always blinked. What is the verb? To savor. To luxuriate in torturing another. Sadism. If someone does this to you, do not give in to the temptation to smile. I tell myself to be the strong woman my mother taught me to be and not smile, but I almost always do. One man said to me, "Do you know who I am? I'm Don Juan, and I'm the best lover in the world. See for yourself." And I thought, good for you, sir, good for you. I smiled at him, laughed even. Another man on another day stood on the sidewalk in front of me as dusk was falling. He was with his friends, and he reached out his arms and pulled me toward him. And what did I do? I've got to go, I said. I've got to go, sweet smile. Walk, don't run. They smell fear, they chase. I will never be six again. I no longer remember what it is like to bask shirtless with a garden against my skin, or for someone to take a picture of my naked torso that they will actually develop at Walgreens. I am 24, and my body makes life dangerous for me. My breasts, my hips, the way I walk. Any woman's breasts, any woman's hips, the way any woman walks. It's all somehow too tempting. Our full lips or thin lips, our necks exposed beneath cropped hair, or our long hair, or the split ends we pick at while sitting on the bus, our pierced or unpierced ears, the infinite circle of belly button winking beneath our shirts. We look too good in our t-shirts and jeans. We look too good bundled up in our coats, carrying houseplants down the street. When we walk home to our apartments late at night, we carry our keys spread out between our fingers and we jump at the shadows of shadows. In the daylight, we pretend we were never afraid. A couple of years ago, in the warmth of summer, I stood naked on a dock, and my buddy was my buddy. My two girlfriends were standing naked beside me, and their bodies were their bodies. Our breasts were our breasts. Our clothes were our clothes that we had chosen to wear and chosen to take off, leaving them in warm heaps on the chilled wood next to the damp footprints which were also ours. When we jumped into the water, we chose to jump in. The weeds brushed against our bodies obliviously, encircling our fingers and toes and hips with no knowledge of or care about which was which. We splashed water with our fists and yelled, but if we were afraid it was only a fish. That thought made us laugh. We saluted the dark, starry, silent sky, and it did not so much as whistle back.
Cleopatra Coleman, reading Heather Burtman's essay, My Body Doesn't Belong to You. We'll get an update from Heather after the break.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments. Ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, You are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Heather Burtman lives with three women and four men in a big house in New Haven, Connecticut. She says she wanted her Modern Love piece to reflect the experiences that she and her female housemates share.
We would come home from work today and someone would have a story about someone yelling at them out of a car window, or being at a bar and someone like touching them inappropriately. And that was just common conversations that happened just at the end of the day. Like, I mean, this past weekend, I was just walking down the street in like a small town in Connecticut, and this car full of guys yelled at me. So it wasn't like remarkable. It was just like, oh, it's sad that this happened again.
Heather says she's catcalled at least every other day, and it gets to her.
It feels very degrading when men yell at you. It feels like they don't see you as a person, and it's a feeling you have to fight. I am worthy of respect and being treated like a human, and it's something that's hard not to internalize in the moment. I think it's something that I have gotten better at as I've developed a stronger sense of self.
Heather wondered if other women who've experienced even worse sexual assault had more of a right to tell the story than she did. But that fear fell away after the piece was published.
I was just really touched by how much women said that that was a story that they had like wanted to hear, or they had just wanted to hear another woman like acknowledge that it had happened. I was very humbled by that. I was pleasantly surprised by the way a lot of my male friends reacted to it, because a lot of them actually reached out to me and said, thank you for writing this. I wanted to understand better, like, the experience of being women, and, like, I know men have a lot to learn, and they were just so ready to listen.
Ultimately, Heather wants her essay to be more about empowerment than loss.
I wanted to end on a note that women do have control of their body, like, no matter how you're treated, your body is still yours. So this moment at the end that I talk about where I go skinny dipping with a couple of my good friends, it didn't matter what our bodies looked like. It was just all about living in the world and experiencing the water, the way the sky looked, and just having joy, like, and being in a moment with friends.
Heather Burtman. She's a graduate student at Yale Divinity School. After the break, Daniel Jones talks about the massive reader response to Heather's essay, and more from Cleopatra Coleman.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments. Ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
Dan Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times, says that Heather's piece really struck a chord with readers.
Boy, did this essay ever sort of unleash strong responses from readers who just, you know, sort of read it in tears and said, this is just brought up so many memories of so many years of walking down the street and feeling like someone has a claim on me, someone who's scary and someone who doesn't wish me well and who wants something from me, and how that just sort of dominates your thoughts for for years. But, you know, she is the writer. It's not her job to solve the problem. It's just to articulate the problem well. And Heather did it just so powerfully in this essay.
And it brought up a lot of memories for actress Cleopatra Coleman as well.
It articulates something that I think, just speaking for myself, have felt and experienced my entire life. But I had a really innocent childhood, lots of naked running around in mud and, like, you know, very much like this essay. At a certain point, it just changes. And as a woman, you just get so used to it. Like, everywhere you go, like, God forbid if I walk past a group of men and then I have to turn around for some reason, I will watch them all look away immediately because they've all been looking or pointing or talking. And so I find this incredibly satisfying and really beautiful.
Thank you to Cleopatra Coleman. You can see her in Fox's The Last Man on Earth and Showtime's White Famous. Next week, Kirsten Vangsness from the CBS drama Criminal Minds reads an essay about a woman whose flawless social media projection of her relationship didn't reflect the reality.
I wanted my perfect love to look like what I'd convinced myself I had. The photos, the Facebook statuses, the narrative of our relationship I'd woven into my head. I had fallen for what I thought we could be together, not the reality of who we actually were.
Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Perotti, Amory Sievertson, and Caitlin O'Keefe. Additional sound design by Matt Reed. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for The New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.